Resources Policy and Finance Committee to order. Chair Heitzman, have you had a chance to review last meeting's minutes?
As a matter of fact, I have, and Mr. Chair, I would move the minutes from April 9th.
Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Oppose? Motion carries. First up on the agenda, we have House File 4787. Chair Heitzman. Once you're settled in, would you like to move your bill to be laid over?
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 4787 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
All right, your bill is before the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, like to bring before you a issue that has been just next door to my district and been peripherally aware of it for quite some time as we've been trying to figure out a path forward. There's a lot of information here, so as we have questions today, I hope members feel free to just go ahead and kind of get through that, because I think that together we can kind of get a better picture as we try to process all of the different things that have happened over the course of quite a long time. We have quite a tradition in Minnesota. I think we could argue today that we work to provide access to landlocked properties. And really, that's what we're here to talk about. The Prinzens have spent the last 2 years, that's the most recent effort, to gain access to a landlocked property. They requested an 865 square foot easement from the DNR in exchange for total control over 1.7 million square feet of land within the rec area. We've talked many times about Cuyuna and the mountain bike trails in the rec area. The Prinzens have received support from all the local stakeholders, city, county, and most importantly, the rec area's Citizen Advisory Council. One of the big questions that comes up immediately is, what do they want to do with the land? And we have a lot of documentation in your packet to go through if you're interested. And bottom line, the exact same thing that the DNR has proposed over the years. And that's to build small cabins to support the rec area and the local economy. If you've been to Crosby and the area around the rec area 10 years ago compared to today, it's almost unrecognizable. There's new streets, there's new sidewalks, there's new businesses. It has completely changed the economy in that area and the livelihoods and the lives of countless people. So back to, what are we doing with the land? As I said, the same thing that DNR has proposed, and that would be small cabins. So the DNR's own management plan calls for cabins to be built on this exact same site. I wanted to make sure that I covered that right off the top so members had that information as they think about what we're talking about here today. So instead of following the guidance of their own rec area advisory council and the local community, the DNR has decided to risk a shutdown of the mountain bike trail system that has been a shining bipartisan success in a former mining community. A lot of folks, when they come to visit, they wonder what they're actually experiencing and how it came to be, and they're shocked to learn that their mountain biking, I'm combining two different things, excuse me, on technically a mine dump, a waste material from the mining operations that were conducted over many, many, many years. So mining has actually created tourism. So you have the mountain bike trails that people are visiting, as well as some of the deepest lakes in the entire state, some well over 600 feet deep, and unbelievable clean water and opportunities for recreation everywhere you look. So I hope that today we're keeping an open mind, listening to all the facts. I'm sure DNR will be presenting, you know, some of their thoughts on this as well today. And I just ask that we just go through that together. And like I said, there's a lot of materials that are included, and there'll probably be discussions after today's hearing also, right, the bills being laid over. So I'll turn it over to my testifier members, and Mr. Prinzen can go ahead with the chair's permission.
All right. Thank you, Chair Eichmann. We'll go to testifiers. Tim Prinzen's up first, June Lake LLC. Go ahead, introduce yourself for the committee and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tim Prinzen. I'm here today to request your support to unlock a landlocked property in Crow Wing County and to save access to the Crow Wing County State Rec area's mountain bike trails. Trails some 400,000 people visit each year. A little bit about me. I'm a lifelong Minnesotan, raised in Crystal, Minnesota, and have raised my family in the Uptown neighborhood for the last 25 years. When I was 6 years old in 1976, my parents bought a vacation lot on Lake Ossawinamakee in Crow Wing County. They still live there today. So for the last 50 years, I've been traveling back and forth from the cities to Crow Wing County. I know the area very well. A little bit about the rec area. Cuyuna was the first state rec area created in 1993 as a means to revitalize the Cuyuna Range, including Ironton and Crosby. It includes 5,000 acres of state land, private land, and undivided interest property. About 80% of the rec area is located in the city of Ironton. It was created for outdoor recreation to get large numbers of people to visit beyond the local area, and that's important, so they have a place to stay. And in short, to drive traffic to the area and increase tourism money spent in the local economy. The original management plan was completed in 1995, but mountain biking didn't arrive until after 2010. Sister legislation was created a Citizens Advisory Council, or CAC, was also passed with the original rec area legislation. I imagine the CAC was created because local folks and their legislators were concerned that the DNR would not pay attention to the people who knew the area best, the people of Crow Wing County, Ironton, and Crosby. The CAC has 13 members made up of the local community, including the state senator, state rep, chamber of commerce members, IRRRB, economic development board, school board, etc. Fast forward to today, why am I here? I know this is a big ask, and I wouldn't be here if we had not exhausted all other avenues over the last 2 years. 2 years ago, April 24, we found a property publicly listed on Zillow. It had been listed since August of 23. It's about 60 acres of property located on a little 100-acre lake called June Lake. It has about 6,000 feet of shoreline and is next to the mountain bike trail systems we love to bike. But there's a catch. It's landlocked. It's located in the rec area and surrounded by DNR-owned land. We believe this is a problem we can solve. We enter into a ground lease with an option to purchase with the property owner, Carrie Treader of Ironton, Minnesota. With that agreement, we will use our best efforts to unlock the property. We called the DNR. A woman named Amy Marrier was our first contact, and we asked about an easement. Her initial response was positive. Land in Minnesota can't be landlocked. A little while later, she let us know that the DNR would not consider an easement. We realized we need to build local support from the ground up, and that's what we do. We got support from the city of Ironton, the majority of the Crow Wing County commissioners, and most importantly, the Citizens Advisory Council. We asked the DNR for an 865-square-foot easement over grass and gravel to connect with an existing road with a plan to build small overnight cabins for the 400,000 rec area visitors. This plan is the same plan contained in the DNR's own management plans. It turns out our plan is their plan. We offer the DNR to have input in the size of the cabins, the number of cabins. We offer a right of first offer for them to purchase the property when we sell it. We offer to swap the easement for the owner's undivided interest in that critical 40-acre parcel, 1.7 million square feet. This would put an end to over 30 years of access disputes and allow for the expansion of prime trails at the western trailhead of the rec area. The DNR said, do not bother to submit your easement application. We disagree and continue to request a site meeting so that we can submit our application. A site meeting is a critical component. We are not able allowed to submit our application until there's a meeting on site. It took 9 months from our October 2024 CAC meeting to get the DNR to meet at the property. While we were gathering support, we were also doing our title and survey due diligence. Our surveyor discovers that the road, Overburden Road, and the trail, a section of Galloping Goose, that the DNR believes they own outright and is in fact not owned by the DNR. It is in fact part of the undivided interest parcel, co-owned by Carrie Treader and the DNR. Our surveyor requested road ownership documentation from the DNR in December of 2024. To this date, the DNR has not provided any documentation that proves ownership. Why is this road and trail important? It is the western trailhead and provides boat launch access, ice fishing access, scuba access, and most importantly, is the critical section of the Galloping Goose Trail. Losing this section of trail would be like losing Interstate 494. It is the main mountain biking loop for the entire trail system. Now the DNR has a problem. How do they continue to access the trail over private property? We have a solution. Swap the undivided interest ownership for an easement in the landlocked property. Plus, allow them input in the size of the cabins, the number of cabins, and a right of first offer when we sell the property. Instead of accepting this solution, they deny the easement application and ignore the access problem. What is the reason for the denial? Their statement is, granting an easement will cause significant adverse environmental or natural resource management impacts. But how is this possible, given the road that we want to connect to already exists, and the use that we are proposing is the same use outlined in the DNR's own management plans? We are left to conclude the DNR wants to own this property. When a government entity restricts access in a way that diminishes the practical use and value of private land, while positioning itself as the only viable buyer, it raises serious concerns. Even without formal eminent domain authority in the rec area, such actions can function as a de facto or quasi-taking. This is not a case of private interest opposing public use. Quite the opposite. The proposal enhances public ownership, expands trails, supports local economic development, and aligns with the long-term recreational vision of Cuyuna. It is balanced, forward-looking solution that protects both the land and the public's ability to enjoy it. The members of this committee should ask why a proposal that delivers more land, provides forever access, and a carefully stewarded development plan is being set aside. A reasonable path forward exists, one that respects property rights, advances public recreation, and preserves the character of this remarkable place. Yesterday, we had a good conversation with Commissioner Stroman and reiterated that we have a solution that will erase any uncertainty over land rights, ownership access through a land swap with the DNR, and an agreement for on an agreement on certain conditions and a right of first offer. Based on yesterday's conversation and additional information, the commissioner let us know that she is going to consult with her staff and review prior decisions. Once again, it is our hope that the DNR changes course and agrees to a conditional land swap that benefits all parties. But if not, it appears the only way to avoid a shutdown of the trails and a calamitous effect to the local community is for passage of legislation. I encourage you to review the information provided in your packet. I thank you for your time, and I'm here to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Princeton. Next up on my list here, I have Ann Pierce from DNR, Director of Parks and Trails. If you could step up, introduce yourself to the committee, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members. I'm Ann Pierce. I'm the Director of Parks and Trails for the Minnesota DNR. The Department of Natural Resources has concerns regarding the proposed bill language. The action under consideration conflicts with the establishment of Cuyuna Country State Recreation Area Management Plan. June Lake LLC submitted an easement application to the DNR on August 2025. The DNR denied the request because the easement would conflict with a 100-year vision of the SRA, specifically creating a commercial atmosphere in the SRA and conflicting with the management objectives of providing public recreation and preserving scenic beauty. The management plan outlines the statutory boundary and highlights that when lands are included in the boundary, it is with support of private landowners and local units of government. Without this support, private lands are not included. June Lake in-holding property was included in the statutory boundary in 1993 with support of the owner of the property at the time. The property was then sold to the current landowner's husband in 1994 and more recently leased to June Lake LLC, both after the establishment of the SRA. The current owner and June Lake LLC were both aware of the property did not have legal access. Furthermore, placing an easement across state-owned land for private commercial use would set a concerning precedent. It would increase the likelihood of similar requests for access to landlocked parcels across Minnesota's state parks and recreation areas, where more than 800 such parcels exist. Implementation of the proposed action would negatively impact the high-quality outdoor recreation experience that the DNR has developed, particularly the mountain biking system within the recreation area, which has been carefully designed in alignment with the management plan. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who would care to testify? If not, we'll go to member questions. I don't see anybody stepping up. Member questions. Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Buerkle. A couple of questions I have is, this being in the state recreation area, in terms of private lands when they're within, what kind of attempt does the state make to purchase and acquire the lands in the process when they're up for potential purchase?
Yes, so the state does make offers when there are willing landowners. The state has the ability to offer what the appraised value is for those parcels, and it's sometimes at 10% above that.
Okay. Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Buerkle. So in the state recreation areas, it's kind of like first opportunity, and then you folks then pass if it's not, if you're not able to come to an agreement on the price.
So can you repeat that last part? I'm sorry.
Going back. So in the state recreation areas, you make, when there's a willing land to sell. So in this instance, was there an opportunity or did the transaction happened and you did not have an opportunity before the transaction occurred?
Yes. So I may not have the exact date right, but when this went up for sale, we did offer to buy it for the appraised value plus 10%, and that offer was not taken.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And then one other quick question is, we've got the property of the undivided interest where there's, if I'm understanding it right, there's joint interest between the landowners and the state. Is that very common across the, with other areas in the state? Have you had that happening with other state recreation areas or state parks where you've got that shared interest, or is this really a very unique situation?
It is more common in the SRA at Cuyuna than it is in other parts of the state, but it does happen in other parts of the state. I could get more information on that about how common it is, but I know at that SRA it is more common.
Chair Fisher.
Thank you. And in those kind of situations, thank you, Chair Burkle. In those kind of situations, does the state ever do anything trying to take care of that divided interest, or how do you folks usually deal with that in that kind of situation? I'm asking because this is very unique as we see, and I'm just trying to find out what has precedence been like elsewhere in the state on these issues.
Yes, so I can give you an example of this actual parcel. When it was first identified that this would be an SRA, that was much more divided, and over the course of the years, we have purchased those sections of that divided interest, and now it is 1/24th with Ms. Treader and 23/24th with the state of Minnesota. So those divided interests have been purchased over time.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Would either of Chair Heintzman or Mr. Prinzen like to respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to have Mr. Prinzen address that question. It's an important one. I'm glad that it was brought. And if we could also, that would be great if Mr. Prinzen could, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Prinzen.
Thank you, Chair. A couple things on the timeline. The legislation that created the Rec Era was in 1993. Mm-hmm. Jeff Olson, who is the partner of Carrie Treader, purchased it in 1994. The management plan was not created until 1995. And so, yes, while the Rec Area statute was created in 93, Mr. Olson had no idea what the plan would be for the Rec Area because it wasn't created until 1995. This is the first time that I've heard that Dan Hamm, who is the person that owned it before Jeff Olson, approved of the property being in the Rec Area. That may be true. I had just never heard that before. I did talk to Dan Hamm before I got involved in the project. With regard to undivided interest, our calculation is that there are 580 acres. The placemat that's in your materials calls out that there are 580 acres of undivided interest in this state rec area. As it relates to the DNR's active engagement in purchasing that undivided interest, as an anecdote, I was able to engage with the McGuire family that has 108 acre undivided interest just west of this parcel. I was able to option that property for $18,000, a nominal amount of money. I think it was the assessed value of the property plus a little extra. I offered that property up to the DNR as part of this process, and that fell on deaf ears. To my knowledge, the McGuire family has never been engaged, has not since been engaged by the DNR to acquire that undivided interest. That is 108 acres, 20% of the current undivided interest available in the rec area.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Prinzen. Next up, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question would be for Ms. Pierce. But before that, I'll just give a little bit of background for our discussion here today. This is a beautiful part of the state, like Representative Heintzman has mentioned. I've taken on two separate occasions groups of friends up to enjoy the Cuyuna, and I have biked, not just on some of those incredible trails, but certainly have enjoyed the very trail that passes through the section of property that we're talking about, the Galloping Goose. Thank you. And so my question for the DNR is that in your denial letter to Mr. Prinzen, that you stated that granting an easement would cause significant adverse natural resource management impacts. And tell me more about that, if it's in regards to his easement, when it appears like you built trail right over the top of the land that's adjoining him. Tell me more about that.
Director Pierce.
Chairman, committee members. Yes, so we did build trails across this property. We do build trails in various areas of the state and also do that in a way that is of least impact to the natural resources. We still do need to manage that site and the resources, and that includes the trails and the land that is surrounding that. So whatever that management can occur can be a variety of different things, but as more people are in that area, it becomes more difficult to do that. And then the other side of that is that the resource management also includes that recreational opportunities.
Representative
Schultz. Mr. Chair, and to you, Ms. Pierce, I'm concerned because from what I understand here, they have a campground that is proposed for this specific site. And at the same time, it's my understanding that that's also the plan that is adopted for the park. Do I have that accurate?
Director Pierce.
Chairman, committee, what I think that is coming from is in 1995, there was an initial plan that identified what the future opportunities of that site is. Since then, there have been amendments, but on that future plan or future ideas of what could be done there, there was identification of having overnight amenities in that location if it ever was acquired. The current plan calls for more overnight amenities. That might be a campground in the southern part of the recreation area. We don't identify private-owned property for having specific things on those locations anymore. But that 1995 plan, which was the first plan, does identify that as a future opportunity.
Representative Schultz.
Mr. Chair, it looked like Mr. Prinzen, did you disagree with that assessment, or was there something that we needed to understand in greater detail?
Go ahead, Mr. Prinzen.
Chair, Ms. Pierce is accurate in that the 1995 management plan specifically says as action item one, develop campgrounds south of June Lake. However, in 2008, the Cuyuna State Recreation Area Recreation Implementation Plan was created, so updated some 13 years later. And it says, if additional property to the west, just south of June Lake, that's this property in question, can be acquired in the future, that area should be considered for a semi-modern overnight use area. So there are two documents in their management plan. I believe the plan has been updated again, maybe in 2016. No changes have been made to the plan that would affect these statements.
Representative.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. So what I'm understanding here is the DNR wants this land. The DNR potentially wants to put a campground on this land, but somehow I'm led to believe that in Mr. Prinzen's case, that a private campground is outside the realm of what the DNR is willing to accept.
Director Pierce. Go ahead.
Chairman, yep. Committee members. I think to reiterate that what we are trying to think about is what that 100-year plan calls for, which is non-commercial use. The other issue with this easement is that it would set a precedent for other sites across the state in holdings of other parks and trail systems, that granting an easement would set a precedent. And that's the other piece of this. Yes.
Rep. Schull.
Mr. Chair, that's actually really concerning because earlier Ms. Pierce said that there are currently 800 parcels that are like this. So 800 private property owners who the DNR is currently potentially landlocking out of the value of their own property, from her words, Mr. Chair. In addition, I think it's also important to note here that within this same rec area, just so everyone knows, there is another private campground that is already within the rec area boundaries. That's the Red Rider Resort. Why is that okay and this instance is not, Ms. Pierce?
Director Pierce, go ahead.
Chairman, committee members, in the situation of the other overnight stay area, that has access to it. That's a private in-holding that has access to it. We are not trying to prevent private owners in creating what they want. What we are doing is looking at, is it the role of the state to facilitate that development with resources of the state, being in this case the easement?
Rep. Schultz.
Mr. Chair, I recognize that there's probably a lot of other questions around the table. I will just make note that, to my knowledge, from the information that I've reviewed here today, it sounds like the DNR might have built trails over the undivided interest property without the support of all of the property owners of that undivided interest property, Mr. Chair, without that approval, which is certainly concerning considering they're trying to stop this additional development.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And I will just come in here again, too. So thank you, Ms. Pierce, for coming today to testify. I would just ask, what do you need from the legislature? What do you need from us? What do you need to hear from us? Because when I hear things like I hear today in regards to this situation and being, you know, afforded an opportunity to have another parcel of land or have things happen that are even above and beyond, that would be a gift back to the state. Why would we not support that and allow for future development here and continued access to such great things that happen up there to over 400,000 folks that are visiting up in that area?
Director Pierce, go
ahead. Chairman, committee members, we are definitely willing to keep working with June Lake LLC. The offer of that specific property came up later, and you know, we are definitely willing to keep talking and figure out if there's a way forward for this.
Rep. Gilman.
Thank you for that. And then can we put a timeline on that? Because when we talk about willing to keep working, and it's been years, and it sounds like there's been a lot of folks trying to get to the table and hearing that there's been months of not having communication back and forth. What do you need from us? Do we need to do a letter of support? Do we need to do, have more conversations, you know, give people your email to reach out to you, to get a hold of you to say, hey, this is something that we want to see, that private landowners can have access to their property?
Director Pierce, go ahead.
Chairman, committee members, you know, in the process of doing this, there's been initial conversations. We've had those conversations and told June Lake LLC what they needed to do. We did meet with them in February, and then we met out on the site again. These are things that we have to go through reviews, and they do take time. And, you know, again, we're willing to keep talking about this and working on it. Thank you.
Rep. Gilman.
Okay.
You're done. Thanks. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions. First, and this is maybe for Chair Huntsman or maybe for research, but have we ever done this, where we pass a easement via legislation to resolve a property dispute?
Chair Heisman, do you want to take that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I would probably have to get back to you on that. I believe that it has been done, but I could give you specific examples at another time. I think that it's fair to say that this effort has been ongoing for decades. The previous owners prior to the leasee have attempted to access their property, and DNR has repeatedly, I would argue, stalled. And been at times negative. As we just heard, the request was denied just recently. And we're kind of at our wits' end trying to figure out, well, what should we do? And it is unusual that we're here today having a hearing talking about accessing private land. I acknowledge that. So it isn't normal for this committee to have this kind of a bill in front of us, but it has been because of the frustration that has built over time when you have very similar accommodations provided adjoining the rec area, and for reasons that just don't make sense. I mean, Representative Figu, we've even had folks at DNR tell us that this shouldn't move forward because there may be a mining interest that we couldn't, apparently because of that concern, move forward. And that is a risk that Mr. Prinzen is willing to accept, that at some point, apparently, DNR believes they may want to dig up the rec area and mine it to reprocess the ore. And I guess I would just say that it is unusual, but it's also quite a extreme circumstance, and that's why I drafted the bill.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, and thank you, Chair Huntsman. I can appreciate that. And it just feels to me like why this is here and not in court? Isn't that what we do to solve land disputes? Have you taken this to court?
Mr. Prinzen?
This was adjudicated in 1995 by the previous owner, and I'll paraphrase what the ruling was. It was a status quo. So we will let the people, we will let the current access that Mr. Olson enjoys and the current access that the DNR enjoys the same. We'll keep it status quo. Since that period of time, ownership around that parcel has changed, and the DNR has gained control of all of the property around June Lake. And if I might address the question with regard to the unusual nature of grant of this situation, what this bill really does, what it really does is it keeps the trails open. It allows for access to be created, and it stops the shutdown of the trail over the undivided interest parcel. It does what the DNR has been so far reluctant to do. And so I would say, most importantly, the last thing that I want to do is damage the trails, damage the riders, damage that community. That's what this bill does. It keeps the trails open.
All right. Representative Finke.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I don't know. Just to be honest with you, I don't know anything about the history of this, right? I do love the area. I've been up there. It's beautiful. But that's not what the bill does. The bill does is grant an easement, right? And it doesn't say the bill doesn't say you're going to put cabins there. And the bill doesn't say anything that any of you are saying. It just grants an easement to a property owner. And I'm very uncomfortable with the idea that we would do that via the legislature, not to minimize the pain and problems that you have felt, but like it's an easement. It doesn't do any of the things Representative Schultz was talking about, just grants an easement. So anything can happen on that afterwards. And I've been reading through the testimony here, and it seems like many people in the area are very concerned. So I just think legislatively, it doesn't make sense to me that this is the solution we've been looking for. Thanks.
Chair Hagsman, would you like to respond to that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Finke, I appreciate that sentiment because there's some complexity to this issue, and it's tough to process all of that having it just presented to you today. We do have a long tradition in Minnesota of respecting property rights, even in inholdings. And Mr. Prinzen is trying to resolve this issue, arguably over this divided interest. DNR made a mistake, and as a part of this agreement, that could be resolved through this bill. You know, anybody can characterize something any way they want, but from our perspective, that issue could then be resolved and continued access to the Galloping Goose as it is today would remain. We're talking about 860 square feet approximately of land that could be impacted by this easement or is impacted by this easement. And it's absolutely in keeping with the DNR's own plan going back as far as 1995 and the plan that's presented to the local community should access be allowed. It's really hard to understand how this isn't just an effort by DNR to smoke out the current ownership and acquire the land through this process of denying access. They do not have the option, DNR, of acquiring in holdings via eminent domain. So apparently this is the plan. Just deny access.
Next up, Representative Jacob. Oh, thank you. Were you done? Were you finished? Okay. Representative Jacob. Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Merkel. So coincidentally, in my neck of the woods, the situation has been reversed where the DNR has had property that's landlocked and they want to cross private property. And it's amazing what a different attitude they take when the shoe's on the other foot. It's really a double standard. They've consumed county attorney's resources. They've consumed taxpayers' resources. They essentially want to have their cake and eat it too. And they talk about spirit of cooperation, the greater good. We need to be able to access the land. You have to. So I'm just having a hard time understanding why when things are one way, the DNR wants to assert their authority, and when they're on the other end of the situation, then they want spirit of cooperation, they want to consume taxpayers' resources, they want to do everything they can to have the access they want to have. So I just think it's unfortunate that it needs to come to this for this to be resolved, but that's where we're at.
Director Pierce, do you want to respond to that, or are you, there's not really a question in there, but.
No, there's
you're
not
good.
Really a question in that.
Next up, I've got Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this question is for Director Pierce. You've heard, and I've read in a lot of the testimony, that this, legislative grant, this granting this would set a precedent. I think you called it a concerning precedent. For the public record, can you talk a little bit about like what is the concern with setting that precedent? What are the implications of setting that precedent? What are the consequences of setting that precedent? Why is setting this legislative precedent from your perspective, from the DNR's perspective, a poor idea?
Director Pierce.
I can speak to that. If we look at the state park and recreation system, like I said, there's over 800 parcels. Those are within the center sometimes of our systems. They are something that we have, could have, if a bill like this goes forward, this is something that we could have individuals requesting that access for other commercial developments, whether it's a restaurant in the middle of Teta Gooch or something along the lines of a bed and breakfast in the middle of another state park. The statutory boundaries of the park and recreation system are set in legislation. When those are set, the landowners within that are notified that their parcel will be in there and they're allowed to disagree with that. There are situations where people have, and if you look at our park system, they have cutouts in them, and those are for that reason. And so that is where our concern is.
Chair Hanksman, did you want to respond as well?
Yeah, I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Gottfried. I think it's important to note for the committee and for the record that this bill in no way tells DNR that there's some kind of new statutory process for in-holding owners to come and demand access. It doesn't do that. But your question's fair, and I would just point out that this process has been extremely challenging, and the committee here today is hearing this issue, it's being laid over, and even then it's not decided, even if we all agreed. This is challenging for anybody to come to a legislator and say, I want to build a restaurant inside of Tataguchi. I don't know that that would go very well. We're talking about something that is entirely different, and the process is extremely challenging, and we'd have to come to some kind of agreement to move forward. I don't think that that sets a precedent, except that in extreme circumstances like this one, a legislator could author a bill and have a conversation about this issue, which may be uncomfortable for an agency, but it's up to legislators to go through that process together and figure out if it makes sense. And if it does, fine. If it doesn't, also fine. So I hope that that addresses that, because that's a question that even I had as I am learning about this issue. You know, what am I getting myself into? And as I learn more and more and more of the details, I'm going, this is really dumb. Why isn't the agency willing to work with folks who are trying to do, I would point out, not at taxpayer expense, build a campground and manage it for the good of this community? So here I am presenting the bill.
Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Heintzman, for that question. Because you actually preempted what my next question was, is like, why is this not setting a precedent? So you saved a question there. I just want to drill down a little bit deeper about the concerns that the DNR has. You know, you mentioned a lot of things that could happen as a result of this. Is the concern with, you know, other property owners coming up and trying to replicate the same process, you know, administrative burden? Is it threat to natural resources? Is it like what is from your perspective the bad thing that happens if this legislation is passed?
Director Pierce.
Chairman, committee, just to clarify, are you saying what is the concern about the precedent? Is that what your question?
Yeah, Rep. Gottfried.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct. Sorry.
Yeah, I think there's a number of things. One would be creating a perpetual Swiss cheese. Right now, there is somewhat of a Swiss cheese landscape in our state park system. When those statutory boundaries are created, the department is directed to, as quick as feasible, to acquire the lands that are within that. And that is to create a more holistic, protected area, right, that people can use. So there is that concern. There's concern with trespassing, having parcels that are within a statutory boundary, and trespassing occurs either onto private property or onto public property, both ways, trespassing issues. There's also natural resource concerns, that as something is cutting through a cohesive forest land or prairie land, it's creating barriers there and to that management of that site. So there's multiple things within that are of concern.
All right, Representative Gottfried. I got two more on the list here.
Yep, I'll wrap up. No, thank you for that. And I guess I would just, you know, all things being fair, I would present to either co-chair Heintzman or Mr. Princeton, how is this proposal different from what was just discussed?
Go ahead, Mr. Princeton.
Thank you, Chair, Representative Gottfried. The word precedent has been used exhaustively over the last 2 years as it relates to this process, and it's one that we understand. The the best way for me to answer this is the way that the mayor of Ironton answered it to me. And I'm going to paraphrase here. If this is precedent setting, then this is good precedent. You are solving a problem that has been antagonizing this entire area for 30 years. You are giving 1.7 million square feet to the state of Minnesota to develop trails that they've had to avoid development on. You're adding an economic benefit to the area. You're not disturbing any vegetation. The road that we want to access is already there. It's already traveling through the rec area. The use that we have is the identical use that they have in their plans. It's not a restaurant. This is not, we're not creating the 100-year phrase that's used in the original plan, that they use commercial atmosphere. We are not proposing a commercial atmosphere. Our use is the exact same use that appears in the rec area today, both in campground and yurt form. We're not proposing a commercial atmosphere. This is not Madden's or Craigens or Grandview. This is silent sports, something that we hold very near and dear and something that we want to help. So totally different. This is not precedent setting. And if it is, it's good because of what it accomplishes.
Representative Gottfried.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate both answers to that. I will note there's a lot of folks in the silent park, the silent sports society, the mountain bike group, that appear very opposed to this. I'm curious about that. I don't need to comment further on that, but I am curious to hear why that may be, given your stated stewardship of that particular type of sport.
Mr. Prince.
Chair, Mr. Representative Godfrey, I assume the folks at Red Raven, Patrick, asked many people up in Crosby, Ironton, up on Cuyuna, to send in what I would call a form letter with their concerns, if that's what you're referring to. I'm meeting with Patrick and that community tomorrow up at Red Raven, and we'll. I think express to them the difference between what their perceptions are of this bill and what the reality of it is. Unfortunately, with the bill, it's a long, long legal description, and it doesn't include a sketch of where the actual easement is. So they don't have this information. I've since provided it to Patrick. Patrick will provide it to the community up there, and I will meet with that community tomorrow at the Red Raven. I'll also be meeting, I also have another meeting with the CAC tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, and we'll be updating them on this situation. So my community engagement continues, and Patrick and I will, I think, come to an understanding of why this is good. That's my hope.
All right, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I'm hearing the testimony today and kind of mulling things over, I think, Mr. Prinzen, if I heard you correctly, since this, kind of the history of it, the DNR has continued to, or has acquired more land in the area since, 1993 or 95 or whatever. And somewhere in that range, there was a court case that was status, just each party can do status quo on that. And if I'm understanding this correctly, it's after that court case that the DNR has continued to access more land or purchase more land, acquire more land. Is that correct?
Mr. Prinzen, go ahead.
Yes, I believe that's correct. There are certainly parcels, especially the parcel to the west of the undivided interest that I think at some point was undivided interest, and then the DNR got complete control of that parcel, whereby it was landlocked. If that answers your question.
Representative Nelson. Yeah,
thank you. And so I think, back in my township days, we worked a lot on, there was two different cartways that came in. And so that brings in the heartburn for me and memories of that. And cartway isn't a process that can happen here. One of the things that is looked at in setting a precedent there is, you know, what was used or considered enjoyment? You know, what was accessed and, you know, previously by the landowner? And sometimes it was land that was granted just verbal permission, and maybe some kids were ripping around on a weekend and kind of lost some, got some neighborly disputes and caused some problems. But, you know, what has ended up happening out of that is that, you know, Cartway was filed. And so the looking at what the enjoyment is, and as I'm seeing this, it appears that there's been what I would call an enjoyment by the DNR. The status quo hasn't stayed the same necessarily for the DNR. It's kind of grown some, but the landowners have really stayed the same. And am I reading this correctly, that you're looking for an 865-square-foot easement? Is that the entirety of it, or is there more than that, or is there unsure?
So, Mr. Princeton, go ahead.
Sure. So the original proposal that we proposed was 865 square feet, a 33-foot radius that goes from what I call the Crabtree parcel to the undivided interest parcel. That would have solved the problem. What this easement does is utilizes, we've heard that people would prefer to have the trail or the road on Hall Pack Road, a road that parallels Overburden Road. So what this easement does is it does that. It follows Overburden Road and it stays off of, in large part, the undivided interest parcel. So that is the difference. Our original proposal was yes for 865 feet. We have that in your packet, and I think a good visual.
All right, Representative Nelson.
And thank you for that. I think that was helpful clarification. And I think as you're probably the bigger desire is to be able to use the hard pack road as your if I understand, or maybe I'm phrasing it wrong, but the hard pack, you know, following an existing road, so there'd maybe be an additional easement beyond 865 square feet. But, you know, your 865 square foot, you know, radius is 33 feet by roughly 26 square feet. So roughly the size of this table right here is, you know, the area that if that was granted, you know, your enjoyment of the property could be complete. And yet we're, the DNR is holding, you know, holding this up. And, you know, it's, I have a question for the DNR here. There was a comment that you had given the appraised value. Is that the appraised value as to what the landlocked property is?
Director.
Was there, like, what is the appraised value and the criteria behind determining that value?
All right, Director Pierce, go ahead.
Chairman, committee members, so what the DNR can offer an interested landowner is the appraised value of their property. And so that would be the property value at this time, or at the time that the offer was made, which was without the access, yes.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. And, you know, so without the access, a number of years ago, I bought on the land sale. It was approved through it was county-owned land that it was tax forfeited. It was adjacent to my property. There was a number of other adjacent landowners, but there was no public access to it. So if anybody could have bought it, it was on auction, but it sold for the appraised value, which, being landlocked property, anybody else that would have wanted to purchase it would have had to provide an easement, and it would have been a great cost to that. And so for myself, that property was worth more than other people that came looking at it. It was, you know, it's listed publicly. There were people that came by and would ask, you know, how much it was to buy an easement through my property to get to that. And I gave them a number, and it was more than the value of the property, because it was not something that was, you know, the easement would have cost more than, you know, been more valuable than the property. And I think what I'm hearing from the DNR is that, you know, they're giving it without an, you know, they're giving an appraised value, but without you know, the lack of access there. But the DNR is the one holding the cards that has the access to it. So just like the parcel that I bought, it was worth more to me because I have access to it. If a neighbor wanted to buy it that didn't have access, you know, that wasn't an adjoining property owner, it would basically had to have been given to them to be worth it. And so that's where the DNR's value is incorrect, because they have an easement. They have access to it. And that's where I would argue that the appraisal value is wrong. And really it comes in short of where it really probably should have been, because they had the access. So I think the frustration we have here that I'm seeing this, just like Representative Jacobs said, is that these precedents that, precedents isn't the correct word, but what ends up happening in situations like this is why the distrust happens in greater Minnesota and probably here in the metro as well for the government. Because they've got you over a barrel and there's no way out, and so we're going to smoke you out until either nobody else buys it or you're done. And the, you know, when you hear people talk about what DNR stands for, we hate it when they say it's do nothing right, because there are a lot of things that are right that the DNR does. But this is an instance that I think the grant, I mean, it's kind of embarrassing that this bill is even before us. This access should have been granted by the DNR a long time ago.
And for our last question, Representative Warbless.
Thank you, Chair. And I guess my question would be to Ms. Pierce, and I'm just curious because it doesn't seem like it would be a lot, but what is the likely cost to DNR to grant that easement? Is there actual Pierce. Monetary cost?
Go ahead.
Chairman, committee members, are you asking what it costs us to go through the process, or are you asking what it would cost the landowner to purchase an easement?
Representative Warbos. Okay.
The
Chair, process. Thank you.
Process.
Okay. Director Pierce.
I can get you information on that. I don't have it off the top of my head, but it takes time and review and things like that.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. I appreciate it. Did Chair another.
Go ahead.
I guess a lot of the points that I was going to make have been pretty well made by now, but I would just like to say that, you know, where I come from, my district, we have Redhead Mountain Bike Park. It has now become a destination. We have, in my opinion, world-class mountain biking up there. I took Rep. Mahmoud up there this past September, hoping to get David Gottfried, Representative Gottfried, up there as well, maybe this summer. I would love to get a chance to go out to Cuyuna. I've heard good things about trails out in Crosby. But the beauty of the development of these spaces and the Mineland reclamation that has happened is it's just shown one more opportunity for the public to get out there, to get outside. We put a lot of value on being in the outdoors and not promoting the kind of private partnership that we could be getting with the Prinzens on this. I mean, it's not even a partnership. It's just access. Access is a good precedence. And I applaud their efforts and staying in this fight, by the way, and enterprise that they have that will pay taxes, because, I mean, right now I assume they're paying taxes on their property, but you put cabins on that property and give people like me and Representative Gottfried access to that to go stay in those cabins and do that tourism, that's going to give this state an opportunity to collect more money in tax revenue from that family. So I just applaud your efforts. A lot of other things have already been said, and so I'll keep it at that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, members. Co-Chair Heinzman, closing comments.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that a lot of the questions that most people have were brought forward today, and if anybody comes back and wants to review our hearing, I think they'll have a pretty good picture of what we're trying to accomplish here. I will just simply add, one of the biggest challenges that I hear about from people coming in to try to access world-class mountain biking has been the challenge of an overnight. And this proposal providing access would get at part of that problem and add to the existing opportunities for a stay in Cuyuna in the rec area that already exist. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I will end it there and renew my motion that House File 4787 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
All right, Co-Chair Einstein renews his motion that House File 4787 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Next up, House File 4261. Co-Chair Hanson, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Co-Chair Hanson is moving that 4261 be laid over for possible inclusion. Your bill is before the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is DNR's annual policy and technical bill. Everybody's been eagerly anticipating the opportunity to hear their presentation today, so I will turn it over to Ms. Keller, and she'll give you a walkthrough.
All right, thank you, Chair Eisman. Ms. Keller, would you introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony?
Good afternoon, committee and Chair Burkle. My name is Barbara Keller, and I am the legislative coordinator for Minnesota DNR. First, I would like to thank Chair Eisman for carrying this bill and the committee for hearing it today. This is our annual DNR policy bill, and I'll be walking the committee through this bill section by section. There are a number of provisions in this bill that are also included in House File 4192, which is authored by Representatives Pinto and Heinzman. That bill was heard in the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee on March 24th and was referred to this committee. But again, those provisions are in this bill, and I will go over them as I'm walking through it. But that's what I'm referring to as the fraud bill, the DNR fraud bill. So I'll identify those sections as such. And that bill, the items in that bill, are related to the use of fraudulent licenses, passes, and permits issued by the DNR. So to begin, sections 1 and 2 of the bill, these are some of those provisions that are in the DNR fraud bill, and they clarify that it is unlawful to issue, obtain, or use a dealer 21-day temporary registration for an off-highway motorcycle or off-road vehicle without intent to follow through with a sale or registration. It also adds penalties to both the dealer and the person who violate that section. This section was needed due to enforcement issues with dealers abusing temporary registration or duplicating them and handing them out. Section 3 begins on line 2.20, and it changes statute to clarify that a person must carry, not display, an off-road vehicle state trail pass to use an off-road vehicle on a state off-road vehicle trail. The current language regarding the display and inspection of off-road vehicle state trail passes is confusing. One section indicates the pass must be viewable, while another indicates it only needs to be available for officer inspection. To clarify, to ensure clarity and inconsistency, we are proposing a technical language change to remove the requirement that the pass be viewable to conform to similar language found in the Minnesota statute relating to snowmobiles. Lines 3.13 to 3.15, this is with regards to the effective date, and this is related to our plans to implement our new electronic licensing system to accommodate a phased approach rather than everything being done at one time. So that's what that language is for. Moving on to Section 4, similar to Sections 1 and 2, which were with regards to that the snowmobile, with regards to the off-road motorcycle or vehicle registrations, this applies that same sort of language to snowmobile temporary registration. Section 5 adds a penalty for people that attempt to create or use a fraudulent snowmobile state trail pass. With advances in AI, we are seeing a significant increase in fraudulent DNR licenses, watercraft, and recreational vehicle registrations. And currently, it is not a crime to make, display, or pass off a fraudulent DNR license, watercraft, or recreational vehicle registration or permit. It is a crime to do so with motor vehicles, but not for DNR licenses or registration. So that's why this part is needed. Section 6, similar to sections 1, 2, and 4, we are now adding the same language for ATV temporary registrations. Sections 7 and 8 are related to CARP. Beginning on line 4.21, Section 7 adds a definition for eviscerated. Section 8 adds clarification that a person may possess, import, purchase, sell, and transport certain species of carp if they are eviscerated. Because invasive carp are prohibitive invasive species, businesses and individuals wishing to use processed dead carp in Minnesota currently must obtain permits to do so. Reviewing these permit requests requires the use of valuable program resources, even though dead eviscerated carp do not represent an introduction threat in Minnesota waters. Additionally, the DNR's invasive species program can focus its efforts on the pathways and activities that pose an actual risk of introduction to the state. Section 9, similar to Section 5 regarding snowmobile state trail passes, this section establishes establishes a crime to make a false statement on the application for a state park permit or to create or use a fraudulent state park permit. Section 10, similar to the previous section in Section 5, establishes that it is a crime to create, use, or display a fraudulent cross-country ski or horse pass. Section 11, beginning on line 6.3, is related to our recent requirements for boating education. It expands the meaning of an exempt operator in reference to boating safety standards and allows someone exempt from the requirements due to age to supervise operation of a watercraft by a youth or to rent a watercraft. This has been a problem that's been brought to the DNR by numerous boat owners and motorboat rental businesses. Under the current law, if a grandfather born before 1988 and is exempted from the requirements wants to allow his granddaughter to operate his pontoon under his supervision, he's required to get the watercraft operator's permit himself, despite being exempt from the requirement. In addition to exempt operators who want to rent a watercraft, exempt operators who want to rent a watercraft are required to take the boating education course, despite being exempt from operating their own watercraft. This proposal clarifies the intent of the original legislation and ensures compliance among users who wish to operate motorboats in Minnesota. Section 12 begins on line 6.21. This is a simple technical clarification on horsepower limit for young operators. Section 13 begins on line 7.2. This is a clarification on what people can rent or lease a motorboat. We cannot rent to people younger than 18 years old, and it clarifies that people can rent if they have taken the short boater safety exam within 180 days. Section 14, similar to past sections, this prevents a person or dealer from using a temporary license certificate for watercraft without intent to follow through on obtaining the valid license, and also adds the fraud provisions for watercraft licenses. Section 15 adds fraudulent provisions to apply to game and fish licenses and permits. Section 16, similar to the previous section, applies the false statement language for applications for permits in addition to licenses. And then Section 17 adds penalties for first, second, and third convictions for people that alter a license or make a false statement to obtain a license. Section 18 begins on line 8.2. and allows a person to ask the DNR License Center to voluntarily invalidate their license if they establish residency outside the state. We have received requests from people that have changed residency and meet residency requirements of their new location to invalidate their residency licenses they purchased here as residents, and we currently do not have a mechanism to do this. For example, if someone moves to North Dakota and establishes residency there and attempts to purchase a resident North Dakota angling license, if it was within the same angling year as when they obtained their angling license in Minnesota and that was still valid, they could not technically get or qualify for residency and get that license in North Dakota. So this is just allowing us to invalidate that license if they request to do so. And they would be required to send us a request to make that change and invalidate it. Section 19 begins on line 8.24. This is a change needed for our new electronic licensing system and allows the issuing fee to be displayed on the receipt for the license rather than the license itself. Showing the issue fee on the license was an issue for programming the new licensing system, so this just eliminates that issue. And then lines 9.28 to lines 9.3 clarifies when the section will become effective. Section 20, this is again in regards to carp. And it adds black carp to the list of invasive carp that must be reported to the DNR. While there have not been any reports of black carp in Minnesota, we do want to ensure people report them if their populations ever reach Minnesota waters to inform the state's management and removal efforts. This is an invasive species that was unintentionally introduced to the U.S. from Asia in the 1970s for use in aquaculture ponds. Again, not yet detected in Minnesota. We would advertise that this species was added to the reportable species of carp in the state via our fishing regulations and webpage. Section 21 adds burbot to the list of fish permitted to be taken by licensed commercial fishing operators from Lake Superior. Commercial fish harvesters in Lake Superior are not typically targeting burbot, but periodically find burbot in their gill nets. Because burbot are now considered a game fish, commercial harvesters are not allowed to retain and sell incidentally captured burbot. Burbot caught in a gill net often die while in the net or in very poor condition when the nets are checked, and therefore releasing the fish typically means they are wasted. There are human consumption purposes for these burbot, and this proposal amends the statute to allow commercial fishers to retain incidentally captured burbot, as it is allowed for lake trout. Section 22 begins on line 10.15 and changes the wording of water supply plans record requirements from unaccounted for water to real and apparent water losses to align with nationally standardized language. This is a technical change to reflect the industry standard language associated with water accounting. In moving to a more specific and complete understanding of a supplier's water system, no water should be unaccounted for. And this is a national standard used by other states using the same water accounting methodology. Changing our statute to align with this practice encourages our public water supply permittees to dig deeper into their water accounting and pushes them to identify the specific places where water losses occur, which clarifies what they need to do to prevent losses. Reporting real and apparent losses will help water suppliers make more data-driven decisions about where to invest time and resources into their system and conserve water, which is a critical resource, especially during times of drought, as demands of water are increasing. And this change does not impact what the DNR requires water suppliers to do, but rather how they report the results of the task. Section 23, this is the last section of the bill, repeals the Lake Superior Lake Trout expanded assessment harvest by zone requirement, allowing commercial operators to take Lake Superior Lake Trout without the assessment. Now that this population has reached management goals, the state is interested to provide flexibility in harvest. Lake Superior Lake Trout Management has been a successful partnership between federal, state, and tribal governments focused on restoring and sustaining healthy, self-sustaining populations. In 2024, the Lake Superior Committee declared Lake Trout fully restored, a significant milestone achieved through decades of collaborative conservation efforts with the goal of maintaining these wild, self-sustaining populations for the long term. Modeled lake trout annual mortality rates in Minnesota waters we're below the conservative threshold of 40% set in the 2016 management plan, which includes natural mortality, sea lamprey mortality, and fishing mortality combined. Fixed quotas in statute limits the DNR's ability to manage the fishery efficiently and respond to changing conditions. Removing these quotas would allow for more adaptive, science-based management while keeping the existing goal of maintaining total annual lake trout mortality below 40% firmly in place.
All right, thank you, Ms. Keller. Are there any questions from members before we go to amendments? If not, I see we have a few amendments. First up, Representative Warwas, I believe that A1 is your amendment.
That is correct, Mr. Chair, and I move the A1 amendment.
All right, Representative Warwas, would you please explain your amendment?
So basically, the amendment is about unexpired timber permits issued before March 1st, 2026. And the goal of it is upon written request to the Commissioner of Natural Resources by the holder of the eligible permit submitted prior to the expiration of the permit, the Commissioner must grant an extension. And these are the reasons for that. There's unforeseen factors that have caused a significant disruption in timber markets between the 2025 and 2026 winter season. The DNR estimates that 75 permits are at risk for forfeiture at the May 31st deadline, which would put a significant financial burden on logging operators. This would be the highest number of unused permits without legislative intervention in the past 6 years. There were several factors that created the situation, one of them being a blowdown event, which created a glut on the market of cheap timber. Housing markets in our country are lower than expected, meaning some forest products. Companies have taken sporadic curtailment for their finished product, impacted wood deliveries. And one northern Minnesota mill has seen a series of unplanned shutdowns, which suspended wood deliveries for several days during the peak wood season. And as a result of these unforeseen factors, timber permit holders wouldn't be able to sell the timber from these permits to a mill. And, you know, to be clear, these permit holders want to harvest the timber. It's just currently not feasible. Granting a one-year extension to these permits would give time for these timber markets to recover and ultimately allow DNR to continue forest management activities.
Thank you, Rep. Boras. Any comments maybe from Chair Heisman or the DNR, either one?
Nothing from me, Mr. Chair, but if DNR has a comment, I'd be happy to hear it.
Ms. Keller? Please state your name for the record and give your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. John Drimmel. I'm the Forest Operations Section Manager for Minnesota DNR Forestry.
Go ahead.
Some context, and thank you, Representative. DNR manages approximately 5 million acres of forest lands. As largest dual certified forest landowner in the United States, FSC and SFI certified, our well-managed forests provide important values for Minnesotans, including clean water, wildlife habitat, carbon and climate mitigation, and forest products, obviously. Timber harvests are used to meet habitat and other forest management goals on each site. And that means in state forests, WMAs, state parks, as in the Bemidji Glowdown, Camp Ripley, national forests through Good Neighbor Authority, and other state-administered lands. This active forest management drives economic action in northern Minnesota. Forest industry is the fifth largest manufacturing sector in the state. Excuse me. This management is accomplished by loggers and foresters on the ground doing the work. Without loggers, DNR forest plans go unmet. So some context, as stated, once a logger purchases a timber permit from DNR, it's their responsibility to sell that wood to a mill. While ground conditions were very good this year, I agree, loggers often voiced limited opportunities to market their timber. We follow statutes, specifically 9151 and 191, and other related statutes, as well as supporting program policy to identify timber permits as 2 to 4 years in length to a maximum of 5 years for harder to access sites. Statute also allows DNR to extend any permit one time for 1 year if requested. Statute also allows DNR to grant special extensions in cases of widespread adverse conditions like warm winters when logging access would cause damage to forest soils. So DNR works with permit holders to ensure sustainable and successful timber harvests. We use the one-year extension when needed or requested. DNR sells 900 permits per year and maintains 1,400 to 1,800 permits sold and uncut depending on the time of year. On average, counting regular and special extensions, DNR extends 300 permits each year, or about 20% of all sold permits. Extensions for a good reason are not uncommon. However, it's concerning to provide timber permit extensions without a specific reason. In the past, the legislature has approved market-driven timber permit extensions. In 2021, DNR worked with legislatures and Timber Producers Association to provide relief to timber permit holders after the Verso Mill in Duluth closed. That targeted legislation supported those most affected by the mill closure. As written, this bill extends currently active and about 1,400 permits affecting 1.6 million cords of wood without a clear reason, including 150 permits that were purchased as, you know, early as since last November and December. DNR is willing to work with the bill author to develop language reflecting market considerations for some timber permits while ensuring the DNR's sustainable management and fiscal responsibilities are met. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other comments from Chair Fisher? Anything from you?
Thank you, Chair Burkle. Thank you for the information. One question I have is there good, would there be any kind of fiscal costs associated with this?
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. Yeah. We just got a request for a fiscal note. I understand. Typically, DNR charges 5% interest to provide a one-year extension. There's also potentially delayed revenue as these permits are extended. And as Representative stated, the loggers, the permit holders, do make choices across agencies, counties, Forest Service, and even private lands on choosing which permits to operate. So there's potential for these permits not to get harvested in the end. We'd have to look into fiscal costs, though.
Chair Fisher, you're good. Representative Warwas, to your amendment.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the agency for that clarification or your comments. And I do appreciate being able to work with you, and I'm willing to work with you to narrow that language. So I will withdraw this amendment.
Representative Warwas withdraws the amendment. Let's see. I see there's an A2 amendment. Representative Schultz, I believe that is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Explain your amendment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do move the A2 amendment. Members, good opportunity right in front of us right now. If you enjoy being out on the lakes or the rivers across Minnesota, you know that in the most recent years, we have added additional requirements for boater safety. And the DNR has developed that software and that training. And if I remember correctly, this came online last year. And as a part of that, Mr. Chair, it has additional stipulations in law that kind of increase the age ranges of folks who have to or who are required to have this voter training. And it is my goal with this amendment that we strike the requirements that would be in July of 27 and July of 28, which would make for age ranges to go to the point of being 40 years old, and instead just return us to a little bit more common sense and say that if you're age 26 or younger, you have to get the training. But if you're older than that, your brain is fully developed and you can operate a boat safely in Minnesota, especially given your life experience. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Your amendment is the A2 amendment is before us. Would the DNR like to make any comments before?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Robert Grecki, Assistant Director for DNR Enforcement. The DNR does have some concerns with essentially watering down the boating safety requirements for those 13 years. It is a phased-in approach, so it does give people that are a little bit older time to do that. And I just wanted to – I just got this information, actually, just a couple days ago. We had in 2022, we had 76 boating accidents in our waters that year. This last year, we're down to 35. Every year, 24 and 25, it's gone consistently down. Our fatalities are going down. And I do directly believe that is due to people taking boating safety classes, being educated out there, understanding the consequences and, you know, the responsibility of boating. And we like those things, hopefully, to stay in effect and continue the downward trend.
All right. Any member questions? Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pull out your bingo cards, folks, because I support the Schultz Amendment. I'm a passenger princess myself, so I did not take the boat driving and boat operators class, but my friend did, and it took her 3 hours. She could have spent, and that was the minimum amount of time it took, because there was an option to pay less to spend less time taking this test. If the DNR is offering people the ability to pay to get out of this test is not necessary. I also think it is just very ridiculous as someone in their late 20s, no, in their late 30s, to have to take these tests after we've been using and operating these boats for a while. And I do think it was just deeply offensive that the DNR was telling people that they could spend less time on, they had a mandatory time that you had to spend on taking the test, and you could pay to get out of taking parts of that test. If you can pay to get out of taking this test, it's not necessary. So I support the Schultz Amendment, and I think it's a good amendment, and I hope other members support this amendment as well.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Chair Burkle. As a person who recently went through the safety training for hunting, and a person, if I would have been born 43 days earlier, would not have had to qualify for that. I guess I wonder from the DNR, what other kinds of permits or licenses is there kind of the education piece required?
Lieutenant Colonel Grecki.
Mr. Chair, Representative, pretty much all of them, ATVs, snowmobiles, obviously firearm safety. We do have safety programs for all of these with requirements with different ages. And that was one of the things with the phased-in approach that this would be consistent, 1987, July 1st, would be consistent with our ATV recreation safety requirement age.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you. I'm trying to process this in real time. is it true that there's different ages for all of these different things, but and then I guess I'm wondering, I think I know the answer, but I'm wondering why it is that the DNR has this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Lieutenant Colonel Grecki.
Mr. Chair, Representative, obviously we want people to be safe. We want people to be educated on how to operate whatever the machine is that they intend to use, be safe out there and responsible. There are different ages. Obviously, hunters, firearm safety is the oldest. It was enacted a long time ago. Obviously, if you're handling firearms in the field, it's important. The boating one is kind of the last one to come in, and we wanted to make it consistent with the ATV one, which was otherwise the last one in 1987 with the requirement of that year.
Representative Purcell, anything else? Are there any other questions? Chair Fisher, any comments? No? To your amendment, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Jordan. Glad to have you on board. And and with this regard, I actually want to ask the DNR, why is it that you have a policy that you can pay more money to have a shorter amount of time?
Lieutenant Colonel Grecki.
Chair, Representative, that's a good question. That was intended for people that are going to one-time rent in a watercraft versus somebody that's going to own and operate one. We agree. I think that's something that we need to look at and clarify because it should be the same. I agree with you, Representative.
Representative Schultz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jordan, my apologies because I didn't bring this as a standalone bill that we could have passed all the way through on its own, gotten full bipartisan support, and made sure that every single millennial especially, could see the benefits of this bill. But we're going to have to work in making sure that this happens this session. So with that, I appreciate the support around the table and would just ask for the DNR to be a little bit more wise in the way that they roll out programs.
Representative Jordan, you look like you want to speak.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason why we rent a boat is because we're not rich enough to have boats. We're not rich enough to buy a boat, so we got to rent a boat for one day because myself and my girlfriends cannot afford to rent and maintain and own a boat. So actually, boat rental people are the people who have less money to spend on these tests. So yeah, this is a good day for millennials. Unfortunately, we are adults who need things like retinol, but we don't need to take more boat licensure courses. So I think we've probably beat this, but I really do have a strong concern about the idea of paying less. It's not a safety thing then. It's not about safety if you can say, well, we'll just charge people to skip parts of this test. That's just actually charging poor people who can't afford boats more for that one day a year they get to be on a boat.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. We're going to go to the vote. All those in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. I see we have one more amendment, the A3, from Representative Schultz. I believe it's yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the A3 amendment. I will hopefully quickly highlight for members why this is an issue. This relates specifically to fishing licenses and small game licenses. This particularly was brought to my attention in the fish house, and I did text Assistant Commissioner Meyer with regards to this. But essentially what happens is if you're in the fish house and you buy yourself a fishing license, and it's, let's just say, January 15th, and you buy that fishing license, that fishing license that you paid the full year-round cost for is only good for 6 weeks, as your license expires on February 28th, and you then no longer have the opportunity for the rest of the calendar year to use your fishing license. So my amendment says that we should make it so that when you purchase a license, this allows for your license to run for a full calendar year, no matter the date that you purchase it. And then in the year 2026, we should be able to do this, even inside of government.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. The DNR have any comments on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. I did have an opportunity to speak with Representative Schultz about this amendment. As you may recall, our fishing season starts, fishing opener this year, it's May 9th, runs to February, the third weekend in February of the following year. Small game season starts middle of September, September 12th, I think, this year. Depending on the season, I think rabbit season is open until January or mid-February the following year. So Representative Schultz is right. If a person only does ice fishing or they buy a fishing license in January to go on a trip, that license right now is only good till the end of that season. They need to buy a new one for the calendar, for the fishing season year. We are in the process of doing some work, simplification work. You'll see something in our press releases coming out here shortly, initiating just a public input process on how do we simplify our hunting and fishing regulations, our licenses that are offered seasons. And this would be something that I'd be interested in trying to bring into that conversation and get some public input on. Administratively, we could count those licenses. It would be a little delayed depending on when they would be bought for that, for our federal aid, which goes on calendar year license sales. We would need to reprogram our electronic licensing system, but that certainly is not out of the question as well. So I guess what I'd like to say is we are interested in talking about this more, and we're going to put it through a public input process.
All right. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Meyer. Any questions for members? Co-chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Burkle. Commissioner Meyer, Assistant Commissioner Meyer, as I'm hearing you explain it, sounds like there would probably be a fiscal note associated with something like this.
It'd be, Mr. Chair.
Assistant Commissioner Meyer, yep.
Some reprogramming costs, nothing major. I think one of the questions is how do you handle lifetime licenses, for example. My grandchildren have lifetime sporting licenses, and that would be for a small game and a fishing license. So, I mean, we'd have to figure out some of those intricacies of this issue. Because the way that those are collected right now, the money comes out and goes into the corpus based on those cycles. So just a couple of things that we need to consider as well. But fiscal impacts will be minimal. It's more making sure right now I hear from a lot of people, oh, man, I didn't buy my fishing. I didn't realize fishing season closed or they're all crappie. You can still fish crappies after the big game or the big game fish season closes in February. It's open year-round. And they forget that, right? So it's just making sure to remind people, hey, if you bought your license on a calendar year versus a seasonal year, and right now it's easy to remember, oh, I need a new fishing license. It's the beginning of a new fishing season. It may require somebody to go back and actually look. Obviously, when we inspect somebody's license, we're always looking at the name, date, all of those types of things. So no impacts there. But making sure people understand it's your duty to know when your license expires then rather than the season. So,
all right. Chair Fisher, any further?
And from what I understand, what you were saying is you're looking, thank you, Chair Burkle. Mm-hmm. You're taking a look at getting public input and probably coming out with some kind of recommendations going forward on the whole process then.
Right. Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Fisher, yes, we will. We are anticipating coming back to the legislature probably next session with a fairly large package of redoing some of our licenses, super sports, you have the conservation fishing license, you have things like that. We used to have the all seasons deer license, right? But we offer over 400 different licenses within our ELS system, which is one of the challenges we have to get the new system up and running, making sure those 400 products are available, are working, and all they all interrelate to each other, right? So we would like to see that reduced, simplify. So that's why we're going to do a big public input process, and this would be part of that. So.
Chair Fisher, thank you. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a prediction. I think, you know, having run a licensing system before is when you go to a calendar year or you go to a birth date, expire on a birth date, you'll actually probably have more non-compliance because people forget. You probably also have less money coming in because you have people who purchase during the year, and if they go around the clock, it'll probably reduce the number of licenses. So I think you will have a fiscal note, whether it's anticipated or not. And simplification needs to happen. I would encourage reducing the number of options versus trying to accommodate the exception. Because trying to accommodate the exception, you create more needs for exception. And we do things, and then the people who made the change are gone, and then we forget why we did them. And I just hesitate to encourage a birth date or a purchase if somebody buys the day of opener on May 10th of 2026 and it expires on May 9th of 2027. They may not remember that, and then they get picked up. So just my two cents worth on it. I think there's a lot of unintended consequences that come, but I do believe you need to reduce the number of options.
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, thank you for those comments. I think there is a fear that we would receive less revenue, especially on a fishing license. A lot of those are bought, like if you're going to go for the opener, you're going out of town for the 4th of July, or it's a great, very nice Memorial Day weekend. Those are years we see more sales. Also, someone who has a license that's in effect until a certain day may think that, oh, I can do that activity until that date, right? So there is that seasonality check as well. All good points, but our system does need to be revamped, and, I mean, this is certainly something worth talking about, I think.
Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to comment on the amendment. I think we could make the converse argument that those that buy a license in the calendar year, in the example that's being addressed in the amendment, would think they already have a license, and you could have more noncompliance due to that, arguably. And then in addition to that, I'm concerned that we're concerned that the people of Minnesota might not have to pay twice in the same calendar year just because of a matter of days. So I'd just like to add my two cents and speak in favor of the amendment. Thank you for that, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions, members? Rep. Schultz, to your amendment.
Thank you. I appreciate the conversation. So thank you for the comments. To Assistant Commissioner Meyer, appreciate you your responsiveness to us on this. I will also add, just for the record, this specific amendment, so we can address it this year, is specifically for the annual angling license and for the annual small game license. It does not impact and it does not touch the lifetime or the three-year licenses. In addition to that, or the short-term licenses, I should say, in addition to that, I will reiterate the point of making it more accessible and more affordable for Minnesotans to get outdoors. For me, Assistant Commissioner Meyer, I promise you I will pay my $50 instead of $25 in this calendar year for the benefit of Minnesota's great outdoors. But I hope that this is the last year.
Thank you, Rep. Schultz. We'll proceed to a vote. All those in favor adopting the A3 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
The motion is adopted. All right, Co-Chair Heintzman, any closing comments to the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I do not really have anything that I need to add. We're at the end of our committee hearing, so I'll just renew my motion that House File 4261, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
Co-Chair Heintzman renews his motion that House File 4261, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. And members, we are now out of time. Oh, yeah, we are out of time. Motion, we're adjourned.